Third generation of Adam. His son would be contemporary with the second generation of Seth, because Seth was born after given to us in the fourth chapter in the 18th verse. Unto Enoch, the son of Cainan, was born Irad, and Irad begat Mahujael. That's all we know about him. He begat a son named Mahujael, who had a son called Methusael, not to be confused with Methusael. You had Methusael, and you had Mahujael. Yes. What's so significant about that? One thing. Notice the last two letters in the names of those children. E-L. Mahujael. Methusael. Wherever you see in the Old Testament E-L as a prefix or a suffix to a name, it's an appendage of the name Elohim, or God. Later you have it in Israel, or Elihu, or Elisha. Or you have the prefix or suffix I-A-H, Jeremiah, or Jehovah. Or the prefix of Jehu, J-E, or Jehovah. It was very popular in Israel later years to append in the meaning of their name the thought of God. But it begins with the contemporary of Enoch. Then men began to apply to themselves the name of God. In its later usage in Israel, it was an honor. It was meant to honor God, that they wanted to copy certain characteristics of God. But we suggest that in its earlier usage, it was not an honor. That in its earlier usage, it was taking upon themselves attributes that belonged to Jehovah. Why would they do this? Remember when Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden? They left under a curse. But all was not black. They left, despite the curse, with a hope. A hope that God had implied to Mother Eve, really, in the sentence on the serpent, when he said, the seed of the woman would bruise your head. They had the hope that there would be a seed that would reverse the current situation. And you remember when she had her firstborn, Cain, what she said. I have gotten a man from the Lord. This was the one who was to produce for this reverse what she thought. He's given me a seed. She had another son, Abel, and she called him a pup. He didn't matter. The firstborn was what counted, and that one was on the scene. Well, things turned out the secondborn was better than the firstborn. But after Cain slew Abel, you knew the seed couldn't be Abel because he was dead. And you knew the seed couldn't be Cain because he was a murderer. So both Abel had disqualified by that single act. So now when Seth was born, what did she say? He has given me another seed instead of Abel who came first. She had trusted that Seth now would be the one to be the seed who would bring about the reversal of the curse. But Seth grew up, he had children, and he died. He didn't bring it. And Enoch was growing up, and in the same time on the other side of the family, to Cain's seed, their sons were growing up, and there was no reversal of the curse. And so finally they said, God won't do it, we'll do it ourselves. And so Irad, who was a contemporary on the other side, named his son Mahujael, who was fight for God. The one who will be God's instrument in fighting the serpent. The one who will bring about salvation. In other words, the problem in the third generation was they had lost confidence in God because hope deferred makes the heart sick. They were tired of waiting for God to act. He had promised to see he wasn't delivering. We will deliver ourselves. And they went forward in the spirit of bringing their own deliverance. Apostasy set in. Now let's go to the other third generation. That was the cross. Let's go to the son of Cain. And notice what it said about him. And this is in the same fourth chapter of Genesis. This time we want in verse 17. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bare Enoch. And he built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. Again, we don't know much about Enoch. All we know about him is that his father built a city, his honor. That's the entire thing that we know. Why does he tell us to go to the city? What's the significance of the city Enoch? The first city in the Bible was the city of Enoch. Why does man build cities? Well, back then, I'll tell you one thing, it was not a population center. There was no population center. You didn't have a large enough population to say, this is just a urban development. We need a new housing project here to house these people. It had to be no other reason. The city was a walled place for protection. Protection from what? Well, later, when Nimrod built cities, it was protection for the wild animals. But this is before the flood. The animals weren't wild. So you don't have protection from the animals. What then did you want protection from? It must be from one particular animal here. Fellow man. Who built the city? Cain. What do we know about Cain? He was a man who was frightened. You remember what he said when God accused him of murdering his brother? He said, anybody who sees him is going to kill me. That's individual. I'll put a mark on you. And in the security of that mark, he lived. Righteous, but he lived. Now he has a son. No mark of that son. He's going to my boy. Okay, they won't kill me. They'll take it out of the second generation. They'll take it out of my son. God has promised, I will be your protector. James says, no, I don't trust that. I'll protect him myself. I'll build a city. And in doing this, you have apostasy. Because you have lack of confidence in the promise of God's protection and taking over the role by himself. Time goes on. Matters go from worse to worse. Situation deteriorates until the earth becomes so polluted and so wicked that it has to be cleansed. And God sends it to flood to cleanse it. And through that flood, he brings eight righteous people. Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Those are the only four whose names we know. The others were called, this is Noah, this is Shem, this is Ham, this is Japheth. But these four families came through that flood. And they brought with them a vision. A vision that God said, when you come through there, go out and multiply and fill the earth. The same vision that had been given to Father Adam. World population through their progenity. It would eventually propagate and fill the earth. But we come to the third generation. The third generation from Noah is a man named Nimrod. We read about him in Genesis, the 10th chapter, and we're going to look at verses 8 to 10. Cush begat Nimrod, Cush is the son of Noah, of Ham, who came through the flood. Second generation of Nimrod, Cush, served with Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one of the earth, who was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calna, and the land of Sidon. Again, we have a city builder. But this time, at least, he's got something to protect himself from. Make a hunter, you protect yourself from the animals. Because the first city he built was Babel. The Tower of Babel, very familiar, the 11th chapter. What was the problem with the Tower of Babel? Well, if we look at the 11th chapter, the first crime was not building the Tower of Babel. The first crime comes earlier, starting in Genesis 11. The whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass that they journeyed from the east, that they found the plain of the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there, and they said one to another, go to, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they made bricks for stone, and five had made for mortar, and they said, go to, let us build a city. And a town. Not to reach heaven. The first crime was the building of the city. The vision carried through the flood was go out and fill the earth. So they lived in tents and built a place to live. But now they found a nice comfortable place. Let's settle down. Houses that are made out of brick are not meant to be moved day by day. They're permanent houses. They had lost that vision of spreading out, of going throughout the world. They had decided to come into one specific location and settle there instead of the location of a rural congregation. That was the first plan. The second plan was the tower. Why did they build that tower? Some might say they were afraid of another flood. They wanted to get above the flood. Let me suggest that if that were the reason, they were smart enough that they would not have built that tower in a valley. The first point you have to do is get to the top of the mountain before you can go. You start on the top, not at the bottom, if you're going to build it to the top of the flood. So the very location they chose for the tower indicates the purpose was not to get above a flood. And that is what they said was the purpose. He said, let us build a tower on the reach to heaven. Let us make for us a name that we be scattered not abroad upon the face of the whole earth. In other words, they wanted to have something that was outstanding, something that would give them a reputation. Now remember, this is the family of Ham. Rivalry is set again. God has said way back at the flood that he was going to bless a chef over the son of Ham. And it's interesting, this word name comes from the same Hebrew root as the word chef. Let us build our own chef. Let us make our own reputation. Wilson, in his word study of the Old Testament, says that they wanted a monument or token of superiority or eminence to denote and signify to all succeeding generations that they were the true original governors to whom all mankind ought to be subjected. It was like men still famous thing today. Whenever asked they got the immortality of the structure. Look what we did. It was the thought of showing everybody else we are God's chosen. That was the apostrophe that you find for the power of Abel. The time went on. We come to another reformer. Things told the same pattern until one man stands out above all other men. A man called of God. His name was Abraham. And you remember the call in Genesis 12, 1 to 3. Get you up. Leave the city, or the Chaldeans, and go to the city that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. This was the vision that was given to Abraham. A separated people. To be not part of the Father's house. To be unique unto God. A covenant. But the third generation comes along. Of the fall. Jacob and Esau. You recall the stories of Jacob and Esau, they're growing up, to stay over the first right over the Mesopotamia. You recall how later, when Isaac was about to die, how Jacob impersonated Esau and obtained the blessing. And then you recall how his mother sent him away. First, because he was afraid of Esau. But second, because she wanted him to get married. That I don't want you to take a wife from these people. Abraham had the same vision when Isaac was there. A separated people that no intermingling with the people of the land. You go back to the homeland. Isaac sent the elder servant back, and Rebecca was brought. Now Rebecca in turn sent Jacob back so that again they would maintain the principle of separation. Esau was not done. Wait. But he looked. He observed what was happening. He gave a lesson from what happened. Let's look at Esau's narrative. The 28th chapter of Genesis, verses 6 to 9, we read about his first wife. And we read why he fought his first wife. When Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob, and sent him to Padan Aram to take a wife from him. And that he had blessed him. He gave him a charge saying, thou shalt not take the wife of the daughter to Canaan. And that Jacob obeyed his father and his mother. And was gone to Padan Aram. So that his father and mother are Christians. But he should go to Padan Aram. And Esau, seeing of the daughter of Canaan, please, not Isaac his father. Then Esau went unto Ishmael and took him a wife. Yes, Mahala, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the daughter of Nebaioth, to be his wife. Notice the reasoning of Abraham, of Esau. He says, my father and mother are not pleased for Jacob or me to marry over the land. They sent my brother. their way all the way back to the homeland to bring back a wife. I want to please them too. I'm not going to marry a Canaanite. I'm also going to marry a relative. A little too far to go back all the way to Haran. Oh, but we got other relatives close by. I'll go to the house of Ishmael. And he goes to Egypt again. And selects his wife, but he still can be separate. Look what he does. He doesn't go all the way. But he certainly goes in the right direction. But then, let's turn to Genesis 36. And let's turn to 2 and 3. And read about the second and third wife of Esau. Esau took his wives of the daughter of Canaan. Canaan, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Aholibamah, the daughter of Enah, the daughter of Simeon the Hivite, and Bashemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Esau. Having gone just a little way, it was now easy to go the rest of the way and say, well, you know, there's not a whole lot of difference between the Ishmaelite and the Canaanite. There really wasn't. Because Ishmaelites were equally worshippers by this time of pagans. And so compromised, and he went right back to what he said to begin with, I wasn't going to do. He married a Canaanite. Take very to it. So what he saw, we find the apostasy of compromise. He stated the right direction, he goes in that direction, but he does not go the whole route. He stopped halfway. He loses the vision of the covenant to separate his people. If you're not going to be fully separated, you're soon going to be fully joined, fully assimilated with the people of the land. We go on to the next major reform. Now, this is one of the most popular reforms in the Bible. Reform under Moses. When God reforms, and God gives them a law. And in that law, he says this thing. These are the principles you will live by. If you don't, you will die by. And second, I have a certain ritual to show you that I will dwell with you. And that was the tabernacle. These were the two main legs of reform that Moses brings in. But our study is not the first generation, it's the third. So let's go to the grandson of Moses. And he's a rather prominent character, even though I dare say if you had asked me before studying this, that if I could ask you, somebody wouldn't know the name. But there's three chapters in the Bible devoted to him, to his story. His name was Jonathan. We read about him in Judges chapters 16, 17, and 18. We're going to pick up the story in just two verses. In Judges 18, verses 30 and 31. And we want to notice the problem with the third generation, the grandson of Moses. And I hope you've got your Bible for this one. Because when I read it from my Bible, I want you to read it in your Bible, and I want you to notice how bad a reader I am. Just notice how I misread when I read my Bible. Okay, I'm going to read now in Judges chapter 18. I'm going to read verses 30 and 31, and I want you to see if you can find the word I just pronounced. And the children of Dan set up the graven image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershon, the son of Moses, he and the sons were priests to the tribe of Dan, the priests of the tribe of Dan, until the day of the captivity of the land. And they set them up Micah's graven image, which he made all the time of the house of God, was in trouble. You know what the word image is? I said, Moses, this guy. And you probably read Manasseh. Because Manasseh went in all of our Bible. And there's a reason why Manasseh's in the Bible, because it's technically old. It halfway belongs there. And I say halfway belongs there. Remember how the Hebrew was written? Only the consonants, the vowels that are to a point. The vowels were put in, but you only had the consonants written. So you wrote Moses, M-S-S, put the dots here and there, put the O and the E-S to get Moses. In the old manuscripts, this is written M-N-S-S. So you think Manasseh. But the N is probably up here in the line to show that it was not Now, really, it was not a high-paid job. The salary is given a judge of 17-10, $6 a year. So it was pretty low pay. But it was a job. Maybe times were hard then, too. I don't know. But anyway, he has his job to serve as high priest. McClintock and Strong, commenting on this, says, there is not any reason to suppose that this establishment involved an actual apostasy with Jehovah. It appears rather to have been an attempt to localize or to domesticate his presence under the symbols and forms of service, which were common among the neighboring nations, but were forbidden to the Hebrews. So there's twofold events. One, the establishment of a sacred ritual different from the only one the law recognized, and the worship by symbols naturally leading to idolatry, with the ministration of one who could not legally be a priest, but only a Levite. Now, we're going to notice a little side note here. And this will bring us to the other proof that this is really Moses' grandson. You notice in the 30th verse, it says, they were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. But there comes a place when they are no longer idolaters. But they're idolaters all the way down to the end of the period of the king. But although that family was idolaters, not all of them were idolaters. Because we like to go over to Chronicles and pick up the story. In 1 Chronicles, the 23rd chapter, verses 14 and 16, in the genealogy, we begin picking up who's who. The sons of Moses were Gershom and Eliezer. Here's the scripture that proves that this Gershom was the son of Moses, and therefore Jonathan's grandson. But then it says, of the sons of Gershom, Shebuel was the chief. Jonathan is totally skipped. He's totally removed, and if you study this, not only is he removed, his son is removed, his grandson, his great-grandson, his great-great-grandson are removed. Hundreds of years of genealogy are just fucked out and thrown in the garbage can. And they skip all the way from Gershom down to a triple great-grandson, Shebuel. Interestingly enough, the word Shebuel means he who would return to God. Evidently, in the case of Shebuel was one who did not share the feeling of his family. David notes this, and in the 26th chapter of Chronicles, verse 24, notice the job that Shebuel is given. And Shebuel, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, was ruler of the treasury. He was put in charge of all the finances. A very heavy responsibility. I think that's a beautiful lesson in itself. That even where there is an apostate family, generation after generation, God judges the individual, not the family. And if one turns around and goes back, that one is not only noted, he's even given a position of prominence for his faithfulness, despite the family. By getting back to our lesson of the third generation, which is the Jebuel, to Jonathan. What are the apostles? Making new arrangements how to serve God instead of following his arrangements and formalism. This introduces the dark period of Israel, the period of the judges. Now, that period is summed up in the last verse of the book. But in those days, every man did that which is right in his own eyes. That's the catch. But there was no king. So each one followed his own way, and you had each person doing his own thing. And as a result, you had idolatry after idolatry, once and over again, they're sold into slavery. But finally, that period comes to an end. And you've got the period of the king. Now, the period of the king started out very bad, you recall. The people wanted the king. God didn't want the king. And God said, they're denying me, so I'll let them have a king. And the first king was King Saul. Now, God chose King Saul, but it was not God's choice. That can be proven through Genesis 49:10, where it says that the kingdom would not depart from Judah. And Saul was not even of the line of Judah. So the first king was the people's choice. He said, you want a king, I'll give you a man who's head and shoulders above his brother. I'll give you your idea of a king, the macho image. He did choose a man who was me, but a man who wouldn't save me. Now he said, you've had your king, and I'll try mine. And then God gives a contrast, David, shepherd boy. But here's my idea of the king. And David had a vision. And his vision was one kingdom under God. And to make that residence permanent, he had one dream in his life. He spent more of the time in that one dream than he did every battle he fought. I want to build God a temple. Because you can't do it. You're a man of war. Your son can. But David did everything he could. He provided all the materials. He laid aside gold for the things of gold and silver for the things of silver. That was his dream, was to build this temple, to have one government centralized under the worship of God. Solomon built the temple. That's the second generation. In building it, he made some mistakes. One was he raised the taxes too high. He goes, that's why he stayed. Now, the taxes were so high that the people began revolting. And so when his son came to the throne, Rehoboam, people put up a protest. They gathered behind a leader, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and they said, lower the taxes. It's too high. You recall the story. Rehoboam went to his older counselors and said, what should we do? They said, you're absolutely right. Yeah, they can't take taxes as high. Lower them. And he went to the younger counselors, and the younger counselors said, you lower the taxes on every respect you. You show them who's king. You tell them that if Solomon beats you with whips, I'll beat you with scorpions. I'll make the taxes coins of ours. He did. The result was obvious. The kingdom split. In the third generation, that vision that David had of one united kingdom under God was lost. Apostasy comes in, factionalism. And you got 10 tribes up north and 2 tribes south, each with their own government, each with their own kingship, each with their own worship, each with their own priests, each with their own prophets. You have it falling away into the third generation. During that kingship, period of the king, in Israel, every king was bad. But in Judah, you had bad, bad, good, bad, bad, good, sort of like that. More bad than good, but you had highlights. And you had one who was noted as the reformer. The one king who introduced a real reform. And his name was Josiah. He was the one who found the book of the law. He was the one who reinstituted the Passover. The great reformer Josiah. He had a vision. A vision again of a separated nation under God. Our power will come to our relationship to God. Three generations later, you come to Josiah's grandson. And his name was Zedekiah, the last of the tribes of the kings of Israel. In Ezekiel, the 17th chapter, verses 11 to 21, you read this call to Zedekiah. We're only going to read verses 13 to 14, because these verses give the reason for the fall. Zedekiah had taken to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, took of the king's seat as Zedekiah, and he made a covenant with him, and had taken an oath with him. He also had taken the mighty of the land, that the kingdom might be based, that it might not lift it up itself, and that by keeping his covenant, it might stand. Interestingly enough, the reprint page 3623, Brother Russell commenting on this verse says, the taking of this oath was the immediate cause of Zedekiah's downfall. He had lost the vision. The vision was our power will be in God. Zedekiah made a political alliance. He made it a trickery, because right afterwards he turns around and says, now who will get me out of it? Egypt will. They're a powerful nation. I'll make a second alliance with Egypt. And then Egypt will come over here, they'll take care of Babylon, and then we got our kingdom in Egypt. Pretty smart. Except Babylon heard about it. And they said, that's enough of that. Off the wall. And they wiped out the entire kingdom. Israel was down the tube. They had lost. Because the vision was lost, and Zedekiah thought, we'll be alliance as his apostasy. Israel goes into captivity. They're there 70 years. Under Cyrus, the decree comes forth to return to the land. And again, reformers run the scene. Ezra, Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, men who see a vision, men who see the idea of returning to the throne of God. Read Nehemiah 1:3. But in this case, apostasy comes in even faster. In 15 years, apostasy starts entering in. You read about it in the book of Haggai. We're going to look at Haggai 1:4. If I can find Haggai a little bit. I have my problem, minor problem.
Shows what happened three generations after the Reformation. I'm quoting from the book, The Church in History.
In center time, three generations after Luther, dead orthodoxy had come to prevail in the Lutheran Church. All emphasis was on purity of doctrine and defense against any departure from Lutheran doctrine. All that was expected of church members was that they should learn the catechism, attend church service, listen to doctrinal sermons, and partake of the sacraments. They were not asked to take part in church work. Nothing was ever said about the inner Christian life and warm religious experience. The center introduced something new. In his own house, he gathered a small group of people who were not satisfied with his former religion. He would discuss the sermon he had preached the previous Sunday. The purpose of these meetings was to foster a deeper and warmer spiritual life. And so they were called Collegia Theotata, or meetings for the purpose of fostering piety. They were little churches within the church, circles of people within the ecclesia, to spiritually grow. In other words, in the third generation, Lutheranism had fallen into sterile intellectualism. Everything was how much you knew more than he knew. We are they who know this. They are they who don't know this. We have the secrets they don't have. But it was not active Christian life. It was not the purpose of the reformation of character. It was not the utilization of the life in the service of the Lord. And as a result, it was an apostasy. So we noticed a trend. All the way from Adam, all the way down to the Reformed Reformation. That when a great reformer comes on the scene, in three generations, it tends to fade. And they go into hypocrisy. Why? I think the reason could be fairly simple from what we've looked at. You begin with somebody, someplace, in position. He sees that things are not right. He comes up with a decision, and because others see it at the same time, he pulls them apart. And this is called a reform movement, whether it's the Reformation or whether it's the movement under Abraham or Moses or whoever. The reform movement begins. But sooner or later, the reformer dies. Now when he dies, this leads to problem succession. Who's going to be carrying on this work? And you got a little inter-party problem. You got rivalry. And when we're talking about the third generation, another interesting study, you go through the same thing, look at the second generation. And you find all the second generation, this inter-party squabbling. Who is going to be in control of the movement? Who is the real reformer now that our leader has passed away? When he dies, this squabble tends to form a polarization. And you tend to then begin to have facts splitting apart. Yes, this little group following this successor. This little group following this successor. And this little group says, we're not going to have any successor. We are the successor. And this little group says, well, I go back to the original reformer. And each one polarizes in his own little camp. And then the third generation is born. And all they've heard as they've grown up is conflict and conscience. Argument and argument. They've lost the whole point of reform. Now they're into the squabble fight. And so they're tired of it all, and they begin falling into the apostasy of the third generation. A very natural trend of events. The last part. We talked about a lot of reform. We talked about reform under Abraham, under Moses, under David, under Josiah, under Jesus of Nazareth, under Martin Luther. There was another reform we haven't talked about yet. A reform under Charles J. Russell. Reform of the Harvest Movement. You know something, brother? We are the third generation. We are just three generations. That reform. Do these problems apply to us? This is a reform of the gospel harvest. This is a reform of the head of vision, the vision of the everlasting gospel. A call was heard. Come out of her, my people. Our grandfathers, at every case, as a rule, speaking movement-wise, our grandfathers were the ones who responded to that call. Some of us are first generation, some of us are fourth. By and large, that's where it came. Was in our grandfather's time. Where do we stand? How do the hazards of the biblical third generation apply to us? complete a quiz. Of course, these answers are ourselves. We've heard these before. But I'd like to make a quiz too as a third generation. You won't need a pencil. It's strictly in your own mind. We looked at the third generation of Enoch. And we solved the problem that most deferred think of the hard thing. How have we reacted to the continuous disappointments of 1914, 1925, 1954, 1980, and the other days you want to pick? Are we able to maintain that original harvest vision despite the prolongation of time? We looked at Enoch, and we saw the apostasy of overprotectionism. I'm going to build the city for my son because God may not protect him. Are we content to leave the supervision of the Lord's work in his hands? Are we guilty of building walls and fences around our favorite reformer against his own advice in the first volume, page 223? Are we guilty of saying, oh, I know you will protect me because I'm strong in the truth, but I better think about the young one. My child may not have that mark in his head to protect him. Therefore, I have to be his protection. We looked at the third generation of the days of Nimrod, and we saw the last loss of world vision. Have we maintained that same spirit of a worldwide gospel urged by Jesus in Matthew 28, 19, 20, that worldwide gospel vision